Podcast Guys takes a long view and a long pride. Spoilers will be commonplace. Listen at your own risk.
Good morning, faithful reader.
Welcome, fortunate seeker.
This is Podcast Guys talking Erratic Errata.
Podcast Guys Talking Erratic Errata is a whirlwind reread of A Practical Guide to Evil, where
a historian
and a literature scholar
tackle the big questions about one of the greatest novels of the age, such as,
are horses just full of children?
What's your favorite Callowin amusement park ride? And why is it Magic Goat?
And what's this fight going to do to property values?
Won't someone think of the economy? Don't think of it so much as a fall, but rather an opportunity to learn how to fly. Red Emperor Venal in the act of succeeding his predecessor.
Welcome back. You may recall from last time we were in the middle of a battle. Not just any battle. The Battle of Marchford. Here, we fought demons. They're done. Here, we fought devils. They're done now. Don't worry about it. Here, we fought the Silver Spears. They're almost done now. Do worry about it. And here, we fear a demon's influence may be spreading. But how much do we have to fear? Oh, ho, ho. Well, just listen to this episode, dear reader. Or listener. And you're supposed to have already read this.
Read this episode, dear listener.
Read this episode, dear listener.
That I think that was one of our more unlayered, direct intros to an episode ever. You just sort of talked about it like a normal person introducing the chapter of the work we're discussing. Is everything okay?
No, it isn't. I'm actually a little confused by the start of this chapter.
Okay.
Now, outside of a comment in chapter one or two or the prologue, we haven't got into the fact that the WordPress version of the story does enjoy the occasional typo, enjoy the occasional unpolished turn of phrase. It's exactly what it is, and it's magnificent. And I don't think any of us fault EE for where it is.
Sure.
It's not like anybody had to pay for it, though hopefully everyone here has. If you haven't given EE money, go to patreon.com/PGTEE, give us money, and then also give EE money. But I'm actually confused by one here. In the first two sentences, it is written, because I have to go at lengths to avoid saying Catherine says or thinks or recounts, because all of those are making claims I don't wish to. Of the original 100 I'd begun the evening with, there were barely 40 left. More wounded among the missing than dead, but it was a hard man who could fight with an eye or a few fingers missing. And it sounds really sensible until I actually considered, what does she mean by more wounded among the missing than dead?
She means that, so she's got 40 people who can fight as after starting with 100. And of the 60 people who cannot fight, most of those 60 are wounded rather than dead.
The missing. Okay.
Yeah. Missing is the noun here. The people are the missing.
But the ones who aren't the 40 are the missing.
Yes. Not,
there are barely 40 left. And then you have of the 60 remaining, the missing and the dead. Which was how I was reading it.
Yeah, okay. she's got 40 people with her. If you replace the word missing with casualties, that might make it more clear, and it means the same thing here.
But casualties are necessarily dead. That's what the word means.
Interesting take.
At least if you're speaking pre-casualty. Okay. Not, informally, casualty. I'm sorry. So, can I continue picking this apart at a tight level, and this time having something worthwhile to say rather than being wrong publicly?
Sure.
Note to the editor, edit that whole first section out, make me sound smart. Catherine is feeling tired. She'd used too much power, she decided. I'd have to be careful about that in the future. Learn to use my names in ways that burned through my reserves, slower than the tricks my teacher had taught me and the ones I taught myself from that. Learn to use my names.
Yeah.
There are three ways I think this word can be interpreted.
Okay.
And all three would be sensible and fine. Perhaps it means names, and she's thinking, I'm in a transitional name. Let me apply this to the future. Perhaps a typo replaced the word aspects with names, which is something I know I would do sometimes. And maybe a typo added an S to the word name. What do you think is the intended reading here? One of which is written out. I accuse EE of nothing but glory.
I fall firmly into the third camp. I really think this was learn to use my name in ways that burn through my reserves slower. Because you don't, when she's talking about her reserves, the thing that burns through those is using her named power. Aspects seem to be, they draw from that, but they're kind of their own thing. They have their own limitations on top of that. And I don't think that she is planning for, as of now, not guaranteed potential second name.
Does she ever get another name?
Great question.
Oh, she does. First under the night. No, that is almost a name, isn't it?
It's pretty close.
No, she actually does. Black Queen. No, she kind of gets that.
Yeah, that's also kind of pretty close.
No, she kind of does.
You want to do Duchess?
I'm avoiding that one. Huh. Yeah, she gets a lot of epithets, but...
And they all are approximately names with the way that she is herself.
Arch-heretic.
There you go. That's a good one.
Which is kind of wild that that's the one that has no powers associated with it. Story weight, which matters, but, you know. Sorry, I'm done getting too into the weeds. Let's get to the real work.
The real work, which Catherine notes, begins when the fighting was over. She's in the middle of this fight, and she's, you know, grappling with the fact that her sword isn't enough to change the world, that if you want to actually make lasting change, it comes after the fight, picking up the pieces, building things back together. She laments the fact that, despite that, the thing that she's actually good at is the fighting, which is also very true. And it's honestly a bit tragic, and I know this isn't breaking any kind of new ground here, but it's worth mentioning because it's starting to be foreshadowed here, that when Catherine truly becomes able to focus on the after for the first time in a serious way is when she has to transition toward focusing all of her attention on the now. She is dealing with crises and will be dealing with crises for the entirety of the story, of course. But nothing draws the attention of her and her allies and literally everybody else on Galernia quite like the Dead King. And that fight truly begins, gets to the final stages, when Catherine is just starting to get into the truce and terms and the planning for Cardinal and all of those things. All of that kind of coalesces at the same time. As soon as Kat starts to be able to really start to rebuild things, when she begins to move towards this after that she's focused on, that's when everything has to transition to fighting the big threat. So it's kind of just a tragic moment for her that until the story is effectively over, she never gets to do this thing that she's talking about here.
You're entirely right, but it's really interesting to me in the way it parallels that her attention goes there in the middle of this moment-by-moment life-or-death conflict. She isn't sitting at her desk at the start of the chapter thinking, well, yes, the battle will be beginning soon, but after the battle, well, then we have to pick up the pieces. Got to plan ahead. No, she's batting away spears and arrows and probably cans of Campbell's soup.
Oh, I mean, in this moment,
it's for their family,
right? In this moment where she's having this thought, it's between conflicts. Like she went from the fight with the devils to the fight with the silver spears. And that's what spurs this, is that she is relishing the coming fight rather than seeing it as something that just has to be done. And that's when she starts to realize that the fight isn't everything and it will never be everything.
For any Precy in the audience, spur is a Calwyn term relating to their barbaric horses that I think the Precy equivalent would be whip the abominations into a frenzied speed.
Hey, speaking of that, stirrups exist, right? We see those people, they're mentioned.
I'm not actually sure whether they're mentioned because that's specific.
I don't recall. We'll have to see when like the cataphracts show back up and things like that. I'm just curious if we've got stirrups.
It's certainly not in the first 2.5 books.
The word stirrup?
Yes.
Oh, well, okay. Good to know. The first 2.5 books don't really have on-screen heavy cavalry in the way that some of the later ones do. So I guess we'll see.
If I were just a little better at Google, I could actually solve this immediately. Search by domain. Stirrup? All right. Chapter 17, Contingent, mentions them. This is the Battle of the Camps, I believe. Chapter 30, Riot.
Chapter 61, Tempo, in Book 3. Okay, so there's stirrups.
I can't commend your judgment, but your pain tolerance is impressive, Archer added. I flipped her off. Goat daughter, she replied into Grebby, ridiculously proud of knowing the word. Sorry, I just enjoy this book.
I mean, that's fair. So as Catherine approaches this battle, the one with the silver spears rather than the one with the devils, she can't really see what's going on because she's tiny. And she has a moment where she wonders if she should have a goblin carry a stepladder around with her everywhere she goes.
I gotta say, Catherine does a pretty good job of establishing her own image, being, you know, named and all, and one of the most successful named of this generation. And I have to say that I don't think she would have accomplished that if her early image was tarnished by being the one who had a minion carry on a stepladder so she could see things better.
Would have been a rough one to overcome, I think.
It's interesting. Because being short is very much a part of her personal story.
Mm-hmm.
It comes up constantly near her. The mockery from friends, the difficulties from being, you know, that freakish, as all short people are. But her fame, which I think is another aspect of her story, rather than that is her story and everything else is below it or something.
Sure.
But her fame doesn't seem to carry, also she's a short queen. No, she's the black queen. And I don't know, it's just nifty to me that her height is present in only a facet of the story.
Catherine's vertical difficulties are, in her story, more related to, or more, how do I want to say this? Catherine's vertical difficulties are more a catalyst for humor within the story, both on like the level that we're reading it and also within her actual story because her friends are cool, than it is in any way related to her legacy, her name, her legend. And it doesn't matter because as much as we goof, it doesn't matter like that she's short. It's just a funny thing for the people who care about her to comment on. But I think that would change if she had a stepladder following her around, because that's basically advertising insecurity, which is not great.
What she really needs is like a goblin to carry a footrest.
Or? To have a goblin be a footrest?
I think you might be onto something. Before we get too down in the weeds, can I get into the weeds on something you said?
Sure.
You called Catherine one of the most successful named of her age.
Yeah.
And I wanted to disagree and say she's the most successful because she's the warden. She does cardinals. She lays out a truce and a term. But you know what? They're at least one and a half more successful than she is, very plainly.
I can come up with one that I feel pretty comfortable with. I'm curious who's making your shortlist.
Theodosian is the one.
Oh, okay.
He does exactly what he means to do.
Sure.
And want to try his name. The Hierarch.
Oh, interesting. I was arriving at maybe the Hierarch, but I feel like his, despite him culminating in something incredible, an early culmination, I'm not counting the Serenity stuff, I'm talking choir stuff here, I don't think that is him achieving what he set out to do. I think that was, he's imminently distractible, and I feel like that's what that moment was.
Which is why he's a half, because
sure,
he consistently achieves his immediate aim. His immediate aim is always achieved because he has just
infinite power.
Yes.
Okay, so I think we're in agreement there that he's an interesting case and hard to put into this. Kairos is a good point. I'd probably agree with that. But what about Masego? He has a pretty solid goal from the time we meet him, and then spends the books achieving that, and even transcends that goal, like does things along the way that were probably outside of his initial scope, but continue to further that goal.
He does that one meme with the knight, where the goddesses say, I made this, and the Masego takes it, reforms it, and gives it back to them and says, you made this.
Also, just he fully apotheosises as much as he wants to, basically.
Apoplexy.
Yeah, he apoplexes. And so, and while we're talking woe.
Yeah.
So I think him. Just going through the woe, I don't think Hakram, yeah, he becomes incredibly successful, but if we're measuring success by at the level we are, where we are talking personal goals here, I don't think Hakram gets there because a lot of his stuff is self-sacrifice.
If his goal had been to restore Namelor to the orcs or something.
Right. Great. But that he sort of fell into that by necessity, it feels. I don't think Vivian, she's got a whole mess of stuff going on and accomplishes things and is pretty successful overall, but like, it's just, that's just not her jam. Archer does Ranger, which is pretty good, but I still don't know if that counts as being successful unless you count killing a dragon or fighting, maybe not killing, sorry, that's probably not the right term to use here, but fighting a dragon god for a while as successful. But the problem is we're
dragon devil god.
Yeah. The problem is we're talking success in terms of, I don't know, intrinsic motivation and accomplishing personal goals. Catherine does that to an extent, but her success is also just in what the narrative values, what the reality values, in that she enacts grand sweeping changes that affect every other named on the continent and most people who are not named. Like, saying that she is one of the most successful named, I think, is pretty easy. Saying she's the most successful, I think, is not too much of a stretch. And all of the names we've mentioned, sure, they had their specific goals and they accomplished them phenomenally. But the scope of Catherine's success and the fact that that is actually valued by reality itself, I think, might put her ahead of everybody, barring, I don't know, maybe like the Dead King. Even if he had succeeded, I think he'd be in the same tier as Catherine. But yeah, that might be it.
There's one named to add, if you're using these metrics, that you can't really remove. And that would just be Black. Because arguably Catherine's victory is Black's victory. That's his success.
To an extent, but, yeah. I think that's tough to do, though, because they do disagree on what her victory should be at various points. And I think that makes it tough. Like, yeah.
But that's part of his plan.
Yeah, that's true. That's a tough one. Yeah, okay. Fine. Black can get, like, a participation trophy.
To quote Steam-Powered Giraffe, attune your ears to the grinding gears. Am I right?
That's pretty good.
Thank you.
Hey, so moving on from, let's see, we were talking about a goblin with a stepladder. Clearly, this whole time. Catherine needed...
Goblin with a stepladder? I hardly know one.
Yikes.
Stepladder.
The reason Catherine needed a stepladder was to see what was going on with the soldiers.
A pitched battle, I assume?
No, it turns out that they had captured one of the corrupted horses and adopted it as a pet, which is whatever. But the line that we're given by... Hune, is that one of the mounts of the Silver Spears was improperly corrupted. And I'm curious here, what do you think the proper way is to corrupt a horse? Is there like a recipe that Hune was expecting them to have followed, or what's...
I don't want to sound like a reactionary, anti-science, homeschooling American.
Okay.
I'm not going to... But I'm going to say the same thing they would, which is, I think the ultimate corrupting force is evolution. Because horses, as we have previously noted, are the worst.
So you're saying that Hugh notices that this horse hasn't changed?
Right.
Okay.
All it has are legs that will break if they step a micron off of the way they're supposed to, lungs that stop working when it runs, a fight or flight response that means sometimes it will drop dead if you surprise it. What else is there to corrupt?
Oh man. So what you've also just described, like, any human who's reached about 30 years old.
Yeah, I'm firmly in the camp that 30 is the start of your life and things are great.
But also legs just don't work anymore, and neither do lungs.
The day I start having back pain is the day I'll start complaining about my 30s.
I'm glad I didn't use that rule for myself, because I would have been complaining about my 30s in my mid-20s, which would have been a little awkward. Or my late teens, actually. I also had back problems then.
I'm going to understand that your late teens and your mid-20s are very awkward. So that's actually appropriate.
All right. Well, then
for
I
everyone listening who's under the age of 30, let me promise you, life is terrible until you're 30 and then it's great forever. And if your life is any different, you're doing it wrong and should feel bad.
Uh-oh.
So this is Hewn talking.
Yes.
So if I can just read from the text, one of the mounts was improperly corrupted, the ogre told me. They've adopted it as a pet. And I rolled my eyes at her with open disdain. I absolutely despise Hewn, and Hewn is the worst. Why was she even talking to me? And then it goes on. Commander Hewn had very steady notions about professionalism, which was half the reason she got on so well with Juniper. And I think that's the reason why she doesn't get along with Catherine. Because Hewn's right, Catherine's wrong. Hewn's good, Catherine's literally evil.
Now, Catherine does have very strong opinions on professionalism. They're just different than Hewn's.
Fair.
However, it is important to note here, Hewn has steady notions about professionalism, whereas Catherine's are just sort of all over the board, depending on, I don't know, who's in the room with her, how recently she's eaten, whether or not she slept the night before.
Position of the moon and whether she can manage to destroy it yet. Why is it there? It's mocking me.
She just sort of, her notions on professionalism are whatever the opposite of steady is. Unsteady, maybe? Sorry, I don't like making up words. In steady.
This opposite of steady, which is an old-fashioned term for dating, would be situationship.
Okay, so Catherine has a situationship with professionalism.
That seems very accurate, actually.
Yeah. Okay. I'm a little disappointed that we actually reached a conclusion there.
But they have a horse. Do they give it a traditional horsey name like Fido or Bessie or, I don't know, William Henry Harrison?
No, they call it Magic Goat.
Well, that's ideal. I like this. Hewn is baffled at this because she lacks the context, which is fair.
Mm-hmm.
Though, again, if she lived in the 21st century, she would recognize that you don't need a reason, but never mind. Catherine responds with, "You use undead goats one time and nobody ever lets it go," I muttered, dodging a proper explanation. In what world is that not a proper explanation? She
right.
used undead goats and they didn't let it go. Is it not proper if she doesn't explain, "I make goat go boom"?
Yeah, I mean, if this is not a proper explanation, she's about one word away from it being a proper explanation. If she had put the word exploding between undead and goats, done. Solved.
But, you know, Hewn's just a dumb ogre with weird notions about professionalism, so why even bother?
She just doesn't get Gen Z.
And Catherine doesn't get defensive measures.
That's one way to put it.
So Catherine had ordered that the buildings surrounded the hearths be evacuated, the hearths being used for the ritual, because she didn't want everybody to be incinerated. And, you know, she's going back over this plan. We talked about this a little bit with the ritual, how explosive it would be, how awful it would be if it got disrupted. I don't know about you, but it feels like this city is already getting pretty, as the kids say, destroyed. And also there's devils and demons running around. Well, devils and demon running around, which feels as though it would make the city less than livable afterward. Am I wrong in thinking that maybe luring the devils and demon to near the hearths and then just letting them turn into big incinerators wouldn't be the worst plan in the world?
I'm sure you could think of a worse one, but losing all of your mages at once?
Just have them leave.
But if they leave one, they all blow.
So they all leave at the same time?
I suspect they would blow before they were yards enough away.
Now, here's the thing, though.
Okay.
Those of us who have read the next chapter are aware...
all of us.
Of course. That Masego can aim the explosion that comes from the ritual breaking.
Right.
Seems like he could protect the mages if he, you know, wanted to.
Ugh, why do we have to give him more work to do?
Okay,
he's
that's
really
fair. Honestly,
busy.
He's done enough. I apologize. You're right. Don't explode the city to kill the devils.
I don't mean to sound anti-American, but I'm against destroying cities.
It's kind of a weird stance to take. Some cities need to be destroyed. It's that simple.
I mean, outside of LA, I can't think of any city I'd wholly condemn.
Yeah, the problem is the handful of cities I was going to mention, I'm concerned that we might have listeners from there and it would be a poor choice.
Whereas any listener who lives in LA, not from LA, nobody's from LA, but in LA, will agree with me.
Right.
If you don't, think about it for a few hours on your morning drive tomorrow.
Right. LA is a pretty safe choice.
So Catherine jumps into the battle against the remaining Silver Spears, and one of them is Funky. There's a Duder who's just hanging him back, not even participating, but it's more armor than man. The metal fused together seamlessly, like a carapace. And, you know, if I had a nickel for every time Cat fought a foe forged of metal, I'd have two nickels, which isn't a lot, but lets me reference Phineas and Ferb that it happened twice.
It is fun that Phineas and Ferb just sort of took an established phrase, and now there's a new established phrase instead of it.
Can you imagine hearing someone in the wild saying, if I had a nickel for every time, blah, 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 I'd, and then either they'd explain what they could buy or that they'd be rich.
Mm-hmm. It'd be
absurd. If I had a nickel, doesn't mean a lot.
That'd be absurd. That's just not what that phrase means anymore.
It means an unlikely thing happened multiple times.
But usually specifically twice.
Yes, but I think that's modifiable. If I had a nickel for every time I got a paper cut while looking through this book, I'd have three nickels. You could pull that off. So we were actually speaking well of Apprentice, but I realized he has not shown up once in this fight. He did a ritual beforehand and hasn't participated since.
Should we read the next paragraph?
Fine, but I'm still going to be mad at him. Let's see. Oh, look, it's Catherine doing all the work again. I was already gauging the fastest path to the front of the line when Apprentice stumbled onto the scene. Okay, fine.
But to be fair to your point, he is sweaty.
Try hard?
Yeah, exactly. And also just kind of gross, like, clean yourself up. Catherine's here.
I find it interesting, however, that he stumbles onto the scene in person. Because he's coming to deliver the news that there's a demon in the city. He got his demon sensor to go off. It's like a Geiger counter. But instead of going beep, 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 it instead gets corrupted and looks like a horse.
What a fun tool.
I mean, it seems whimsical until you're in the situation, at which point nothing really helps. But he comes over to tell her instead of sending a magic. Is the reason for that just because with the demon around, magic is too unsafe?
I think it's two things. I think it's that, and also, if there's a demon around, you should get all of your people who can fight a demon together, like Apprentice and Adjutant and the Squire.
I wanted to argue with you because nobody there can fight a demon, but no, nobody there can win against a demon. They are the ones who can fight a demon, in the same way a kindergartner could fight me.
I mean, Apprentice can fight a demon.
Okay, that's in the way a third grader could fight me, solidly. I am not a large man. I'm not short, by the way, and just not large. And third graders these days, none of them know how to read, and they've all been trained to kill. That's a pandemic for you.
That's, I was going to say, you know, a utopia, but it's also the pandemic.
Well, violent video games.
Truly.
And the dissolution of family values in this country.
It's the pandemic, it's this year's Game of the Year winner, and it's families dying to demons, maybe? I'm unclear on that last one.
I think families dying to demons make society worse. And I'm willing to say it, even if nobody else is.
And it makes third graders better at fighting adults.
Probably. Like, you know, hard times make hard third graders.
Good times make soft third graders. Yeah, of course. We all know how the nonsense goes.
For people in school systems that aren't the U.S., by the way, third graders, we're talking about people who often start the year at about 8 years old and end the year at about 9. I was old for my age, so I started at 9 and ended at 9. My co-host was not. He started at 8 and ended at 9. I did not know him then.
Can we adjust the like, I don't know, quatrain, whatever you want to call it, from that to soft demons make hard third graders, because this one's so fleshy and yucky?
Wait, this is a spoiler for later, but I think we find out that the soft demon does, in fact, make a hard third grader. Because it's just a little child who's very difficult to fight. That's a hard third grader.
Okay, so soft demons are hard third graders. Hard third graders make good times?
No. It goes badly.
We'll work on it. We'll workshop this and have something ready for the next episode.
And that's a patented podcast guy's promise we won't keep.
Oh, absolutely not. Well, I'll forget I said this in about 30 minutes.
So Masego lets us know that the demon is in the city because it came inside one of the Silver Spears.
Gross.
Which, is it that easy? Like, can you just get around spells by going inside of something? Because that's pretty much child's play. The Magic School Bus did that 25 years ago, and they didn't even have technology back then. Just magic and school buses.
Most things can't go inside of people, though. So, it's a special case. That's demons for you.
That will be our April stretch goal. If you get our Patreon to $100, we will do a miniseries on the magic school bus. Do I mean the books, or do I mean the show? Probably mostly the show. It's easier for me to access. And also, weird case if I like it more than the literature.
But the concern here is that the grinning cataphract in the back is the demon, since it is staying back, it's keeping an eye on things, it's being weird. And while corruption spreads instantly through touch, according to Catherine, just sort of being in the same area is really bad. Just takes a little bit of time. And this presumed demon has been hovering right next to most of Catherine's soldiers for an entire battle. As Catherine notes here, even if it, the demon, lost the battle, all it had to do was wait. And to that I say, yikes, and even, oof.
So Catherine has to act.
Yeah.
This time, actually does have to. She dealt with this demon before, we know.
That's a fun way of phrasing that.
And she tells us the memory of her last fight with the creature, also a fun way of phrasing it, remained fresh. Colon, I'd gone in unprepared and been effortlessly crushed. And I just gotta say, well, gee, if only you'd had a warning, Catherine. If only there were any way to possibly have known that that was anything other than the most wonderful idea anyone has ever had.
But sometimes things just come out of nowhere and are a complete surprise, and there'd be no way to predict that they'd go poorly. You know, that's just life.
Like lightning on a clear, dewy morning?
Hey, yeah. So we've been talking about how different names feel certain ways to their holders. Blacks, machinery, and all of that. We get Masego's here. We get the apprentice feel here. So I'll just read that real quick because we like to have that on record. His name is sort of pulsing off of him, and Catherine can feel it. It felt like lightning and morning dew, something clear and crisp and deceptively cruel. Steel under silk. The bite of it felt only too late.
So that's pretty cool.
Fits for him. I like it. And they kind of rally together to go kill the demon. And as they do, soldiers split away for us without there being a need for orders, driven away by old instincts branded into the minds of all the peoples of creation. Named are coming. Stand and die. Run and live. That's just nifty. The idea that Catherine has more of a sense for magic than the average person does. And we got to see that develop in some ways.
Mm-hmm.
But we know the average person can still feel some degree of magic. There are situations where, you know, a quiet falls over the field or what have you when there's some great act. And I don't think it's just the sky split open and people see, but rather there's a static in the air of something happening. But people can't sense all magic all the time. But when named are coming, this fundamental truth of creation, there's a sense for it. The story pulls at all hearts. I like it.
It is a neat thing, and it also is a great way of establishing the kind of scene that we all imagine when the two important people duel in the middle of a war or whatever, during a catastrophe, you have the important people striding towards each other while everyone else moves out of the way. Cool. There's a metaphysical reason for that. I like it. It's good.
What isn't good is that the horse from earlier whinnies, and that makes Catherine say, butcher that beast.
Whoa.
Yeah. This is a horse. And by ordering it butchered, Catherine proves she is no longer Callowin. Also, her enemy is a corruption thing, and that horse is at risk of actually being corrupted into a threat. And there's nothing more Callowin than butchering your own horses in the face of an incoming threat. So she's truly Callowin. And that... Wow. It's what we call the Callowin dialectic, at least according to Hegel.
That's powerful stuff.
Well, you know, Hegel's powerful stuff. Everyone listening should go read Hegel so that they can recognize how great it was that they never had to study Hegel. Don't study Hegel. Marx did, and look what happened to him. He's dead now.
Wow. I appreciate the warning. Thank you.
So Catherine and Masego go into battle, and they're strong and cool, and there's a little bit of them forging their way to the big cataphract and killing everything in the way because they're inconsequential. But in this, Catherine is confronted by a minor nonsense enemy, and she swings her sword. Two impacts, and as I continued advancing, the horse and the rider's heads tumbled on the ground. And this slaying of a horse, which has nothing to do with my previous conversation about horse slaying, is actually a really unusually important moment. If she had just slain the rider, she'd have an unguided war horse on the battlefield, which would be bad, but, you know, it's just a dumb beast. But in this corrupted situation, who knows what's up with this horse? Maybe it will explode. Things explode around demons, I think.
Sure.
I know I would.
All right.
I just think it's nifty. She takes the care to slay the horse, because she is truly no longer Callowyn, because she's truly Callowyn.
This paradox is really starting to... You're starting to build up evidence for
it. Okay, it's a dialectic.
Sorry.
Either learn philosophy or get out.
I choose to get out, then.
All right.
Easy choice every time. So Catherine and Z's start fighting the thing that is host to a demon. There's some, like, magic going back and forth, some fire, some stabbing, you know, normal fight stuff. And then Catherine sort of just stabs at it, and it moves quickly, and there's a blast of lightning and all these things, and she just gives us this observation out of nowhere. Mind, they are fighting something that she assumes has a literal demon of corruption inside of it, puppeting it. And she says to us, whatever, the corruption ran deep in this one. Yep. Thanks for your insight, Catherine.
I'm sorry. I don't follow. Can she put into plainer speech? This is a really complicated thing.
Yeah, there's a lot going on here. But there's just a demon of corruption in the guy, corrupting him. Like,
which
inside,
means...
deep inside of him.
Oh, okay. So you don't want to get too close or use magic or anything.
Right. And the apprentice is definitely not grabbing this guy with some kind of lightning coil immediately following this. And Catherine's not fighting it with, you know, close range blades.
Hey, I'm actually reading here and you must miss something. That's what's happening.
Yeah. There's a lot of that. Catherine uses her name power directly on this thing. Z's is spellcasting at it. Z's expressed concern over using magic near a demon. And given what we are working with here, the information that these two are working with, he's now casting spells directly at a demon. Did something change? Is it a result of the wards? Is it just because it has a physical body that it's safer to interact with now? Like, that it's got a host? I don't know. It seems odd how willing he is to just directly do magic on this.
I will say that Catherine using her name is not concerning, because she already got corrupted by it, and you can't corrupt a name twice, because that's double jeopardy. But just as things are getting a bit rough, and the demon is choking Masego, Hakram enters the scene.
Oh, nice.
And you know, if I had a nickel for every time this chapter had a sudden change of mood because it said character entered the scene, I'd have 2 nickels. Which, you know, isn't a lot, but it's a quote from Doofenshmirtz.
And it's a good thing Hakram is here, because the fight is a weird one in that the thing they're fighting can move extremely fast and isn't really even touching the ground. It's kind of just a corruption puppet, which is pretty neat and horrifying.
An eldritch thing was moving it according to ways beyond that of creation. There's nothing wrong with this, but I'm just having flashes of H.P. Lovecraft, who was bad, saying that something was non-Euclidean.
You don't like Euclid?
I don't have feelings on Euclid, but if I did, they'd be negative.
Fair.
And you know what? That's the hill I'm willing to stand on.
Very nice.
Hakram rolls up and invokes his first aspect that we see on screen.
A martial name has the aspect invoke?
No, his aspect is stand.
The REM song.
Yes, all of his aspects are REM songs, actually. Some of them are just deep cuts. It's a pretty cool moment. He moves up and sort of just, I mean, stands and is immovable and is incredibly strong in this moment. First aspect for him, awesome. I do have a complaint here, though, and it's pretty major. I'm worried that EE forgot what chapter this is happening in, because the previous chapter was titled Stand. This one is Deliver.
So that's his next aspect.
I love the idea that Adjutant has stand and deliver as two very Adjutant style aspects.
Actually, though, right?
It's more like mugger or highwayman style aspects to have them combined like that.
Nothing wrong with that. But we know that they're all going to be REM songs, so actually we better hope Hakram dies in this fight, because otherwise we might get to his third aspect, the end of the world as we know it.
It's weird that his third aspect so jarringly breaks from the convention of aspect names.
Yeah, but it's the last time any aspect can do that.
So Z's starts invoking a spell, but this is actually invoking, not... I use the word invoke for an aspect, and I stand by that, but this is like magical invoking rather than just making the thing.
So Thaumavoking?
Yes, Z's is Thaumavoking. And we get this spell here, which I'll read just his words, because there's a lot going on while he's reciting the spell. And then I have something to comment on it. Let's see here, where does it start? Yeah, so in M'Saethwa, again, we get, though I hunger, I am never sated. Through grass and ground I crawl, devouring all I behold. My blood knows the call, my flesh the craving. Nameless Eidolons, thieves of heaven's grace, grant me flame. And two big snakes of fire come out of his shoulders, and he controls them, and their heads are the size of chariots, and they slam onto the demon.
Like a quadriga?
Yeah, exactly. So this is the same spell, I think, as what he used at the Battle of the Three Hills, if you recall, where he made giant flaming serpents come out of his body and fight, well, and make a big line of explosions. We don't, correct me if I'm wrong, but we don't often see specific spells repeated by named casters. Like, sure, the legions use fireballs regularly, and presumably healing magic is a similar spell every time. But this idea of a spell in the classical, like, Vancian sense, we don't often see from named, especially people who are as big and powerful and creative as Apprentice here. It's tweaked a bit, but it is the same spell. So it's neat that we, you know, here we have it pretty quickly back-to-back. It's used twice. I don't know. It's just weird. Maybe not weird. It's interesting that it happens here and not very many other times where an actual, I don't know, prepared spell, an established spell, a recipe-based spell, if you want, is used more than one time.
And I don't know why that would be the case, but that does seem true. How interesting. Well caught.
Thanks. Kat also catches things in a with her face, and the things she catches are claws. She gets her face clawed really bad.
That must hurt.
No, because it hit the paralyzed side of her face, the corrupted and cut side of her face. You know, the one that had a needle in it and she didn't notice a while ago. And so she gets slashed up and it draws lines on her cheeks and she doesn't flinch. And then she does one of those famous weird cat taunts that honestly is not as impressive as I think she wants it to be. This thing claws her, gets past her guard, makes her face bleed, has wrecked side of part of her face, and her response is, wrong side of the face. She basically says, ha, you already hit that part before and completely destroyed it. You can't do any more damage there. I don't feel like that's a good taunt. She's basically saying you were too successful the first time.
Catherine has strong, that sign can't stop me because I don't know how to read energy.
He really does.
So what order did Catherine give when she started this long, drawn-out fight?
I think she said butcher that beast.
Do you know what's happening when the fight finishes up?
I think they're butchering that beast.
Yeah, and I gotta say, that is not an appropriate battlefield speed of following orders if you want things to work out.
Have you ever tried to butcher a horse with swords? Maybe it takes a while.
No, not with swords.
Yeah, maybe it takes a while. Hey, but what happens when they butcher the beast?
Well, according to Catherine, the horse allowed its stomach to open, which is a freezing of all time. Spilling out guts.
Okay. And
that took the shape of a misshapen child.
The horse was pregnant?
Yeah, with a baby. Like a... Ah, gotta go.
Oh, yeah. I forgot that my co-host is a coward. So the horse allows its stomach to open, great turn of phrase, and its guts come out in the shape of a misshapen child, which is all sorts of nasty, and most of the nasty, in fact. But also, the horse was pregnant, and that is a beautiful moment, and I think we should celebrate that. The baby, humanish, comes out, it's twisting around on the ground like a normal baby would. It falls out of a horse and starts to crawl, twisting and turning against the stone. Catherine, in the back of her head, she, you know, like when all babies are born, she hears a laugh that turns into mockery. It feels like hot knives ripping through her mind. It scatters her thoughts. You know, if you're present for a birth, what else could you focus on besides the baby? And I think that's what Catherine's explaining, just in her weird Calwyn way. And, like with all births, Archer puts an arrow in it. Hunter says it's huntering time, and then jumps down and hunters all over the demon. The baby's a demon. It was inside a horse. Oh, no, so the horse might be corrupted now. Catherine did say corruption was done by touch. Oh, I'm really concerned about the horse. However, that is all the time we have for today, so we will have to find out the fate of Magic Goat next time. So, join us next week on Podcast Guys Talking Erratic Errata as we discuss flesh ribbons, horse teeth, and orc bones. Wade in their baby-shaped entrails. Podcast Guys Talking Erratic Errata is a fan-made podcast discussing Erratic Erratas, a practical guide to evil. Check out the full serial at practicalguidetoevil.wordpress.com. Intro music for this episode was Cradle of Your Soul by Lemon Music Studio. Music for the epigraph was Learn to Fly by Onoichenko Music. Demon Static is Radar Static, ambient soundscape. You don't get outro music. Deal with it, cowards. The music is provided by the generous license of pixabay.com/music. Go and support all the artists who make this work possible by providing their stories and sounds free of charge. If you'd like to support this podcast, follow us on Twitter at TheLongPrice. Do you have questions, comments, or contributions? Are you overwhelmed by the urge to correct our errors? Email us at thelongprice@gmail.com. If you'd like to materially support our work, find our Patreon at patreon.com/pgpee. Join the ranks of our patrons and be called by name. Receive personalized stories and art, and access at least one patron-exclusive tangent. We implore you, don't consider joining unless you're already supporting the artists who make this all possible. Special thanks to our patron and villainous hero, Gray. Our patron and liege, always the claimant, never the named. Our patron and guardian, the Fey Knight. Our patron and mentor, the traveling teacher. Our patron and dear friend, Aaron. Our patron and inspiration, the hopeful romantic. As well as the hordes of cattle below. Next week, Chapter 31, Splite.